Well, today, opposition forces in Libya are making gains, but U.S. military officials are warning that the Libyan regime remains strong enough to retake the initiative if the coalition doesn't continue its air support. Elsewhere in the region, Syrian security forces fired tear gas on thousands of protesters today as that government tries to clamp down on the most serious unrest since President Bashar Assad took the reins from his father 11 years ago. Unrest continues in Jordan, with the government accusing the opposition of taking orders from foreign powers. Rami Khoury is editor-at-large of the Daily Star and director of the Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut in Lebanon, also, of course, a frequent guest here on Here and Now. Rami, first of all, what has been the reaction in the region to the no-fly zone?
Well, like most things in the region, especially most things having to do with American and European military action in this area, it's been mixed. Some people are for it, some people are against it, and some people are in between. But I think the majority of public opinion is for it. I think there is a clear desire by most people, most average people in this region, to help the Libyan people who are revolting against the Gaddafi regime, to help them and to get rid of Gaddafi. Governments in the region are a little bit more hesitant because possibly they might feel this is a precedent that may come back to haunt them in case military power is used against them one day. But I think the majority is still for it.
Well, you mentioned some of the people are for, some are against. Some are actually involved in enforcing the no-fly zone. You're in the United Arab Emirates today in the Gulf, and the UAE is helping enforce the no-fly zone while also sending its troops to support the regime in neighboring Bahrain. You know, there's criticism here in the U.S. Or in the Arab world that the West is cherry-picking which regime to back, but Arab countries seem to be doing it as well and are, as I said, participating in the no-fly zone. We have about a minute till the break, but your thoughts on that?
Well, welcome to the world of political leadership. I think the lesson is that governments will do what they believe is in the best interest of their people and or the best interest of their leadership staying in power, their incumbency. It's a very strange moment when you have Qatar and the United Arab Emirates sending their airplanes, to their fighter jets, to be involved in the no-fly zone, and you have Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates sending small contingents of armed troops to Bahrain and one area in Libya to help overthrow the regime, and the other area in Bahrain to help keep the regime in place and put down the rebellion. So this is the world of politics.
Rami Khoury, editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Beirut. Just a taste of his observations from the region. We're going to take a break, come back with much more. We want his thoughts on Syria, Jordan, and why it is that Arab countries are choosing the sides they're choosing. Back in 1 minute with Rami Khoury, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rami Khoury of the Daily Star newspaper in Lebanon, who today is in the United Arab Emirates. We're talking about Libya and beyond. And Rami, I just want to make sure I've underscored something you just told us before the break about the fact that we're seeing Arab countries, you know, supporting a coalition in taking action against another Arab country. This is enforcing the no-fly zone in Libya. You say that this is almost as historic a moment as the Arab revolt we're watching itself.
Yes, it's rather unusual to see this going on. It's happened once or twice before, but it's very rare that Arab governments join an international effort against other Arab governments. So I think this is something that has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. There isn't a blanket judgment that can be made. And Arab governments are very edgy these days. They see these revolts, these citizen revolts breaking out all over the place. There is a very common grievance that all citizens are expressing in these revolts, that they want their citizenship rights, they want corruption ended, they want accountability of government power, they want representative and credible government, and many Arab leaders are not prepared to do that. So I think people are, they're a bit jumpy in most of the leaderships in the Arab world, and they should be, because the people are finally revolting against the non-democratic systems that have ruled in this region since most of these countries have been independent.
Well, and you've told us in the past, many of these uprisings we've seen have been about young people not able to get jobs, not able to get married because they don't have any money, tired of the corruption in the governments ruling them. But tell us more about Syria. As we said, the question has been, as we look at each of these uprisings, is it for the reasons we just described, or is it sectarian? We know in Syria there's a predominantly Sunni population, but the ruling elite comes from a minority Shiite sect. So how do you view the current unrest in Syria?
I don't think it's really sectarian. There may be some people who are resentful of the Alawites who are in control of the ruling power structure to a large extent. I think it's a combination of what drives most of the rebellions around the region, and it's been pretty limited in Syria, but it seems to have increased in the last week. It's a combination of indignities that people feel because of power structures and governance systems that are so centrally and tightly controlled with a very heavy military dimension or security dimension to them that the average citizen doesn't feel that he or she has any real power, has any real say in what's going on, combined with some problems of tangible issues, material issues like jobs or housing or economic opportunities. So it's the combination of the two, but most of the people who are rising up are doing so for the intangible issue of rights, of dignity, of being treated as a full human being, as a full citizen. And this is what's striking about these uprisings. And everybody is asking for constitutional change. They want their constitutions to really be credible and meaningful and to give them citizenship rights.
Well, you say the uprisings in both Syria and Jordan are the most significant leap forward for the Arab revolt. Why? Is that because these were countries seen as being the most stable within the case of Jordan, a leader that was friendly with the West? And in the case of President Bashar Assad of Syria, someone who was seen by the West as someone who could, was open to reform. And I know I'm looking at it through a Western prism. You're there in the region. But so why do you think that this is such a significant thing that there is unrest there?
Yeah, I said that Jordan and Syria should be watched carefully because if things start moving there, it's the most significant step since the Tunis and Tunisia and Egyptian uprisings, which overthrew those regimes. And I say it's important for two reasons. A, if there were to be significant changes in policies or in regimes and leaderships in Syria or Jordan, it could have major implications across the whole region, the Levant region, especially because of links with relationships with Israel, with Lebanon, Hezbollah, Iran, and Iraq. There's so many issues that come into play there, so the repercussions could be huge. The second one is because the people in Syria and Jordan who have been limited so far, the people who have been demonstrating, have come right out in the open and said, we want less interference in our lives by the security forces in both Syria and in Jordan. And this is really a daring and meaningful move for people to come right out and challenge the role of the security agencies in two countries that where the security services play a major role. They're very pervasive, they're very powerful, they're feared in some instances. They don't mess around, they play hardball. And for people to publicly challenge them and say we want them to get out of our lives and just do their job, which is security, but don't interfere in other things, that's really quite significant. And it represents a significant crossing of a threshold of fear, which I think needs to be recognized as quite a historic step. If people are prepared to do that, then there's something serious going on.
Well, Rami, just in the minute or so we have in Jordan, the government is saying that the protesters there are Islamists taking orders from places like Syria. In Syria, we're hearing that President Assad is considering lifting the state of emergency that's been there. They've allowed some people out of jail. Just in the minute we have, how do you think both these countries are going to fare?
Well, I think the nature of the demands in Jordan are less severe than they are in Syria. They're asking for constitutional changes, for the king to be a constitutional monarch, to fight corruption, have a more representative parliament. I think a lot of the issues in Jordan the king can address if he summons the courage to do so. In Syria, it's more serious, I think, because they started just saying they wanted changes, and now some people are starting to call for the overthrow of the regime. They can address these issues with really significant changes, but once this process starts, once the government starts responding to the demands by making serious changes, the likelihood is there will be even more serious changes that will be demanded. So this is the problem that the leaderships of the regimes have. If they give in a little bit, then they fear that it's a slippery slope and they'll be pushed by their people for changes that will eventually possibly drive them from office. So it's
Rami Khoury, I've got to thank you there. The Daily Star, always a pleasure to hear from you live on a cell phone from the region. Rami, thank you. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.